Today's Teisho will be case 49 in the Blue Rock collection. Sun shows the golden carp is out of the net. Engo's introduction. 7 piercing and 8 breaking through, seizing the drums and capturing the banners, 100 barriers and 1,000 checkpoints, watching the front and guarding the rear, holding the tiger's head and securing its tail. Even all these are not comparable to the veteran master's ability. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. That also is not a great wonder. Tell me, what do you do when a person of transcendent experience comes? See the following. Main subject. Sancho said to Seppo, the golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? Seppo said, when you have got out of the net, I will tell you. Sancho said, the renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot find even one word to say about this topic. Seppo said, I am the chief abbot and have much to attend to. Secho's verse, the golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say it remains in the water still. It shakes the heaven and moves the earth, swinging its fins, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale, raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds, and a cool breeze comes. A cool breeze, yes. A cool breeze comes. Who in the whole universe knows this? To thank everybody for coming here today on this beautiful summer day to practice Zen, to practice Chan. I must say, probably nobody would say a bad word about summer on a day like today. It's just so beautiful. You know, you've probably noticed that the weather this summer has been very gentle. You know, by this time, on occasion, we have had crushing humidity. You know, just amazing humidity. And sometimes it can be incredibly hot. Really, I can remember Julys where it's gone up to 100 for 4 or 5 days. I remember walking down College Avenue maybe 10 years ago, and I was going to get something to eat in the food court in the student building, and I was walking down the street and it was completely deserted, and as I was walking it felt like I was actually carrying a heavy weight. It must have been about 100 degrees. You know, we have those days, but for some reason this summer, you know, it's been very cool. The other day I got up in the morning to meditate, and it was cold. It was actually, I think, 60 degrees or something. It felt actually cold. It's really wonderful. And, you know, the sun, we've gotten some rain. So all the plants are green, and the sun has been out, and the sky is clear blue. So it's just perfect. And most people in the summer take their vacations. So, you know, that's wonderful too. You know, it's not like when we were kids, we would get the whole summer off, right? You know. But now, as adults, at least we do get some time. I hope everybody gets a little time to rest and not have to worry too much about everything. But you know, modern life is very, very complicated. You know, really extremely complicated. And except when we're on our vacation, it's very difficult to feel that you're you're not overwhelmed by so many details. You know, it's just really very difficult. Probably, no matter what kind of job you have a lot to worry about. You know, I remember I used to work as a cook in a restaurant. When I was when I finished my first 4 years of college, I wanted to do some backpacking in the Southwest primarily. So I had a friend of mine, Larry Sullivan, a college buddy of mine, and we agreed to meet up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the plan was we were going to get summer jobs, and we were going to save enough money to do like half a year of backpacking. And we had had jobs before. We had worked on summer jobs when we were in college. We used to work construction jobs. So we thought maybe when we went out to Albuquerque, we would work construction until we could save enough money. And then actually our plan was to get into Albuquerque around January or February and work until around June so that we could actually have the summer off. I really made a mistake when I said we were looking for a summer job. We wanted to have the summer off and start working a little earlier. So indeed we did get there after Christmas, right after the Christmas holiday, and we met up in Albuquerque, which was pretty amazing in itself, that we were able to find each other in the middle of that city. And we found a place to live, and then we looked for jobs, but this was 1975, I believe, and it was a major recession. There was very little building going on in the United States. In fact, the economy was in quite bad shape. And we had been in recession for a while, and it was just getting worse. This was in the period after the Vietnam War. So there weren't any construction jobs. Nobody needed laborers or carpenters. So my friend Larry got a job grinding jewelry, polishing jewelry. In an Indian jewelry factory. It made Navajo jewelry. And according to New Mexico law, you have to have a few Navajos if you call it Navajo jewelry. So this company employed the minimum number of Navajos, and then it had all these hippies polishing the jewelry. So my friend Larry Sullivan is a very big Irish guy with hair the color of a carrot. And he used to have a long red hair tied behind his tied behind his head with a band. So you would see these people who were clearly Navajo, and there'd be this big red head standing out. And he put on his goggles and just polished jewelry all day. He hated the job. But I got a job cooking in a restaurant, and it was an Italian restaurant that was quite successful at that time. It was near the university, and it was a kind of had a corny name. It was Mamma Mia's. And the man who owned it was named Ed Meislick, obviously not Italian. But anyway, he had an Italian restaurant, and the chef was Italian. Had never done anything like cooking. And I love cooking today. And it seems so simple. You know, cooking is so simple. You have to, I used to make tray after tray of spaghetti, for example. You know, in Italian restaurants, you know, spaghetti is served all the time, at least in this kind of an Italian restaurant. And it's every dish has some spaghetti with it. So you don't make the pasta fresh with every dish. It would take forever. So they make, ahead of time, big metal trays full of pasta, which is oiled so it won't stick together. It's just a little bit undercooked. It's just sort of al dente. And then it's cooked, cooled, oiled, put in these trays, and there might be 30 of these trays in the walk-in refrigerator. It's a refrigerator so big you just walk in. It's got a big door on it. And so one of my jobs was to make the spaghetti. Another one of my jobs was to cut up eggplant and fry eggplant for eggplant parmesan. And that was a wonderful job because you cut the eggplant, you put it in egg batter, then you bread it in flour and crumbs, cracker crumbs, and then you fry it in olive oil. And, I would fry like cartons of eggplants. And another job was stuffing manicotti, you know, so you have if you've ever seen those pastry sleeves where you put filling in one side and there's a little nozzle and you squeeze the cloth pastry bag and it comes out the nozzle. That was filled with ricotta cheese and spices, and so I would make a bunch of manicotti sleeves, you know, the pasta sleeves, and then I would fill it full of cheese and put them in little stainless steel trays, and I would make maybe like 100 of these and store them in the walk-in refrigerator. So, you know, in a certain sense, this is like the simplest job, right? But everybody in the restaurant was very stressed. You know, it was like a high-stress environment, even though, you know, making spaghetti is so simple, right? Making manicotti is so simple. Making sauce is so simple. But, you know, the environment of a restaurant is really high pressure. The reason is that if you had no customers, it would be great. Right? You could just make the food and relax. But what happens is that the restaurant opens at 7 o'clock at night. There's nobody. And you've got everything set up. You've got all your manicotti, all your eggplant parmesan, all your veal parmesan. It's all ready to roll. You've taken it out of the refrigerator and it's sitting on the counter. And the hot water for the spaghetti is boiling. And nobody comes. And nobody comes. So you're sitting there tapping your hands, wiping the stainless steel counter. And then suddenly there's like 80 people in the room, right? And the waitresses all come in, and each waitress comes in, and there's a wheel, a stainless steel wheel, and the waitress hangs the order. So if you've been a waiter or waitress, you've come in and you hung, maybe you hang your order on, there's a little clip on the wheel. And she'll say, that's two manicots, three veal parmesan, you know, a steak, a trout, and this and that, you know. And so as these orders come in, you've got to get them in the oven. And the waitress is going to come back. This place didn't have waiters, it just had waitresses. The waitress is going to come back in, say, 15 minutes and say, I'm pulling. So they come in and say, I'm hanging, I'm pulling. I'm hanging, I'm pulling. And it isn't just one waitress. It's like 20, it's not really 20, but maybe 8 or 10 waitresses. So they're all coming in, I'm hanging, I'm hanging. And you're putting stuff in the oven. And then they all come in, I'm pulling, I'm pulling. Of course, if you don't have the stuff ready when they come back, they get mad at you, because you're going to cost them their tip. See, if the client is not happy, no tip, and if the food is too long in coming, no tip. So these waitresses, they were very attractive, you know, but they could be really mean to me. You know. I was actually afraid of them. And I had a lot of tension, you know. There's a lot of tension in food preparation. If people don't realize, the chef was a guy named Bill Garrison, who had been in the army most of his career and had become like an army, very, very good army chef. And I thought he was so cool under fire. We once did a party of like 200 people, and I was on duty during this thing, I had been doing this maybe for a couple months, and the party just overwhelmed me, the sheer numbers. And when Bill Garrison saw I was having a hard time, he stepped right in, and he was just cool as a cucumber. You know, he just handled 200 people, no problem. He just, you know, put it in the oven. He worked through the orders. It was amazing to watch him. And yet, he had a serious drinking problem. Sometimes I'd see him in the office just rubbing his face. The stress was so great, you know. And even though he seemed cool, you know, underneath he was very stressed. And sometimes at the end of the day, we all worked, all of us who worked at this restaurant, would go up to the bar. Our day would end around 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock. And if you've handled customers all evening long from like 7 till 11:30, and it's, I'm pulling, you know. At the end of the evening, you're not relaxed. You're both tired and wired, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like you're very, very nervous, so there's no way you're going to go to sleep, but you're really exhausted. You know, it's a strange feeling. And and I was like the third cook. There was the chef, and then there was cook number one, cook number two, and there was cook number three. And I was, you know, like the junior person. And we would all go up to the bar and watch Star Trek reruns, right? Because in those days, in Albuquerque, at around that time, they'd show all the Star Trek reruns, and we would compete to see which one it was, you know, so. Within half a minute, you know, these guys could identify which episode it was. You know. So we would compete for that. But they all drank like fish, you know, because of the stress. And it's quite common to run into people in the food business who have alcohol problems, because that stress. Also, customers really demand quality. You know, they're, even if they're not paying a lot, they really demand quality. And if something's off, if something's not hot, or if something's overcooked, people can really hit the ceiling. And part of Bill's job as chef was to deal with unhappy customers. And, you know, these people would come in and they'd say, you know, that was a terrible meal. They'd have eaten everything, right, you know. And he'd just deal with their hostility very capably. You know, he'd say, I'm sorry you didn't like the meal. You know, sometimes he'd pick up the check. Very rarely would he ever argue with them, you know. Yet I know it took its toll, because he'd be up in the bar, you know, drinking at the end of the evening. And he eventually developed a heart problem. Maybe he already had it, but it got worse during the time I was working there. You would think a job like that could be, you know, simple. I had never been on the production end of food before. I'd gone to restaurants, you know. But when I was making the food, and when I saw that the process could be quite stress-inducing. And the social situation, you know, waitresses coming in and yelling at you, and then, you know, actually, cooks are notoriously mean to waitresses. This is quite common in the restaurant business. Maybe it's changed now. Maybe there's a new generation of cooks and chefs. But there was a real battle between the waitresses and the cooks at this restaurant where I worked. And I even think Bill said, if you let them walk all over you, if you don't show them who's boss, they'll walk all over you. And so, you know, they pretty much walked all over me. If I forgot something, they killed me for it. You know, like they said, I'm pulling an eggplant, and I looked inside the oven, no eggplant, And then you have to put it in the microwave, right, and it's just not the same, and it still takes time. And, they would just be furious. They'd let me know, you know. So I was afraid of them. Yeah. Anyway, you know, after working at Mamma Mia's for, I guess, maybe from about February to June, my friend Larry gave up his, I gave up my job, and I was making $80 a week, which seemed like a fortune then, but my rent was like $40 a month. It wasn't that nice of a place, but, you know, things used to be cheaper. Anyway, my friend Larry gave up his miserable job grinding and polishing Indian jewelry. Now, we went up into the mountains, you know, and that was just such a great experience, because, you know, we would just hike all day long up in the mountains of New Mexico. They're really incredibly beautiful. The Pecos Wilderness was one of the places we went outside of Santa Fe. And I can't describe it to you except to say that there's nothing like it in New Jersey. If you, you know, nothing, you know. If you go to the Adirondacks or something a little, but you know, some of these peaks are like 14, is that 14,000? I guess that's true, right? 14,000, 12,000, 14,000 feet tall. Now Albuquerque itself is at 5,000 feet. And the mountains outside of Albuquerque are like a 10, the Sandias, the Watermelon Mountains. But when we were, it's like 12 and even 13,000 feet peaks that are perpetually under snow. And there were elk, and you know, all I owned, actually all I owned was like sleeping bag and a foam mat. I had like, you know, changes of t-shirts. And I had a couple of pair of blue jeans and maybe like two pair of shorts. And I think on this trip, I left some of my stuff with a friend in Albuquerque. I mostly just had t-shirts, underwear, socks, and my camping stuff. And that was it, you know. And every day it's the same. You get up, you have breakfast, you start walking, you have lunch, you walk maybe 10 or 12 miles. And, you know, when you're up there in that environment, it's so different from like being in a hot kitchen. It's so easy to be calm and have a stable, calm mind. And I think it's almost universal. You know, there's something about being in the natural world, which I believe is you know, our whole evolution has prepared us for feeling at ease, I think, in the world of nature. Maybe I'm naive about this. I know there are people who hate going out into the woods. You know, they hate the bugs and they hate the dirt. And I know there are people like that, you know. But I think that people have a natural affinity for, you know, the world of living things. You know, there's this wonderful biologist who's written a book called Wilson, E.O. Wilson, who wrote a book called Biophilia. Biophilia means love of life. And he said he thinks human beings are hardwired to love the natural world, to love living things, plants and animals. And I think he's right. I really do. I mean, we evolved over millions of years in a certain kind of environment, and you know, when you're out in the woods like that, day after day, your mind takes on a different character. You know, your whole consciousness is different. I think the mind has many fewer thoughts. It's resting serenely in the present, and there's a deep sense of connectedness to things around you. And I really believe this. I think that the mind, you know, they've done studies, psychological studies, of people in their response to the natural world. And they have actually found that when you show people pictures of like green trees and things like that, they almost immediately, on the whole, become more relaxed, calmer, and so on. And they've gone all over the world and showed people these pictures. And regardless of where you're from, there seems to be a lot of agreement about what feels comfortable, what feels good. And I really do believe that that human beings probably weren't meant to live the way they live, you know. I mean, we didn't really, evolution hasn't really prepared us for the life of, you know, constant stress and the kind of complexities we live with. I really believe that. You know, they've done a lot of studies about stress, and it turns out that, you know, stress is very damaging to many organs, really. First of all, it apparently causes a hardening of the arteries and plaque formation in the arteries. They didn't know this until quite recently, but constant stress seems to affect your circulatory system somehow. And even if you don't eat a particularly high diet high in fats, somehow being stressed produces a tension. And they just recently did some studies that I was reading about memory, and it turns out that stress greatly impairs your mental functions, that it affects your memory, it causes memory to deteriorate more quickly, and it impairs other mental functions too. So there's a whole range of problems that are caused by stress, and I think that suggests that we really weren't meant to live this way. We really weren't. Body and mind aren't really well adapted to this kind of, we're constantly given situations that we can't respond to naturally. And yet the endocrine system is in high gear and the adrenaline is pumping. And so it really sort of, it's like putting the brakes on your car but then stepping on the gas. It really causes a lot of wear and tear on the organism. And the reason it does is because I just think we weren't meant to live this way. And when we do get out, I think, into the natural world, we begin to feel, I think, more comfortable, more trusting, more relaxed. At least that's how it was for me. After I got out of, after I got out of that job and I went up into the mountains with my friend, we just had a wonderful summer. When I needed to take a bath, I just got into a stream and took a bath. We ate, terrible food, basically, things that came out of packages, a lot of macaroni and cheese and things like that. But it was just breathtakingly beautiful every day. And at the end of that period, I had to get another job, and it was back into the madness, really, because I was really out of money, and so I got a job managing a restaurant. Since I'd worked in one, I got a job managing a restaurant, and I thought maybe being a manager would be easier than being cook. I had a little thing that I put on my desk that said manager, little sign. And people treated me with respect, so I thought, this has come a long way since I was a cook, But it was no better. Actually, manager is like a terrible job too, because, if the dishwasher doesn't show up, you have to be the dishwasher, the cook. So I realized, I get to do all the ordering. The manager's job really is to be, you have to consult with your cooks and make sure that there's all of these food items. You have plenty of bacon and eggs in the refrigerator, and you have to plan, this is the busy month, so I'll need to order extra eggs. And then if there aren't eggs, if you run out of eggs, you've got to call you can't just go to the store. You have to call usually a company that provides, you have a contract with a company. You have to call them up, and they don't like having to make an extra delivery, and you have to argue, and then there's a charge. And, they may not be able to come out until at the end of the day, so you just have to hang around the restaurant until they show up and make the delivery. And there's problems with spoilage. So you've got to make sure everything, you have to be on top of every detail in the restaurant, basically. You have to go through the wine list and make sure all the wines are there. You have to inventory the bottles. So when I realized, what the heck have I got, I thought manager, I'd come in and tell people what to do, and I didn't have any idea. But really, I was busy all the time. And, I was also in charge of the money. So at the end of the day, if things don't add up, you have to do the tallies at the end of the day in any kind of a restaurant. And if you're short, or you're over, you could be there till 3 o'clock in the morning trying to reconcile the books, So I had spent 6 months with three shirts and two pair of pants, and just getting up every morning with the sun at my back, and about halfway through the day it was in my face. listening to birds and watching elk, and then 6 months later I was, staying up until 3 o'clock in the morning trying to reconcile the books, and you know, as I say, I had to get there early in the morning, you know, like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and if the cook isn't there, the breakfast cook isn't there, put on the apron, start flipping the pancakes, you know, because you don't want, you can't tell customers something's happened today, no breakfast, you know. It was quite a job. It was 6 days a week and really seven, you know, and it was astonishing, really. And very stressful, I have to say, incredibly stressful. And so, you know, after doing that for a while, I thought, you know, I don't think I want to be in the restaurant business. I think I'm going to go back into graduate school. School was easy compared to work, you know. So I went to graduate school in English because I was sure it had to be easier than running a restaurant. You know? But it wasn't, you know. It's very stressful. The different sources of stress, you know. I was office mates with a guy named Blake Rombach. I don't know whatever happened to him, but he spoke like 4 languages. He was a comp lit student. And he had just gotten back from Germany, and he spoke fluent German. He spoke fluent French. You know, he was pretty good in Italian. And he was a medievalist, so he had Latin under his belt. He was learning Greek, right? And it was like, no matter what I said, it was wrong. And it wasn't that he was picky. It was just, I usually was wrong, you know. It's like he knew so much. And he was my age, you know. And it makes sense, you know, when I was flipping pancakes, you know, he was in Germany learning German, you know. And when I was looking at the deer, he was learning French, you know. But, you know, in that context, it gave him such an... I wouldn't trade, you know, I wouldn't... That was the best... Those were the best, you know, 5 months or 6 months I ever had. And maybe a little longer than that. But it was just, it was heaven, you know. I wouldn't trade, but, you know, I couldn't live up in the mountains like that my whole life, right? You know, come in and, you know, wash dishes for a while. You could live that way, but I just didn't want to live that way. I loved it, but I just couldn't see, being 55 years old and living in a tent up in the mountains illegally. I just couldn't see that. So I had to deal with life. So I got this graduate job, TA ship, right? It was just murder because everybody seemed to be smarter than I was, you know? Blake was one person, but there were all these people who, you know, they had read Heidegger and they were very... I always cite Heidegger because he's my nightmare, right? But they read all this philosophy. When Derrida came out, they seemed to be effortless. Derrida, blah, 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 you know, and it was like, I would sit there and read this stuff and think, what the heck is this about? You know, I have no idea. And the whole time was like this, right? And then when you write your dissertation, you finish your dissertation, you have to get a job, and the shocker is that, you know, actually there aren't that many, you've gone through 7 years of it, there aren't that many jobs, you know? So at the end of all this time, you have like less than a 50-50 chance of getting a decent job. And so then you have to, at that time I was making $12,000 a year, and you have to fly out to the national conference, and that meant buying a suit, which I didn't have, and an airline ticket to New York from Seattle. And so I easily spent $1,000 just on the conference. That's like out of my gross income of 12. And you have to go into this room, and all these strangers are sitting there, and they'll ask you questions about, and you're so, you know, this is like you're dying to get a job, right? It's like you're a hungry person trying to eat, you know, and they have all the food, right? So it's a psychologically stressful situation unless you have tremendous self-confidence. So you walk into that room, and they really don't mean they want you to do well. They're looking for a colleague who will be a good co-worker, you know. But it's if you don't have great self-confidence, it's like the Spanish Inquisition. You know, you feel like, oh my God, I'm going to go in there and just look like an imbecile, right? You know? And then you try to field these questions, and sometimes you drop the ball, and it's not going well, and you can see that they're trying, but it's just not clicking. And I realized there were these code words that they used in these interviews to end the interview quickly if it wasn't going well. Apparently, one of them is, well, let me tell you about the benefits, the health. That means that's the code word that head of the interviewing committee is usually signaling, let's get rid of this guy. So I go in, I'd be there for 15 minutes, and they say, well, let me tell you about the benefits, right? So first, you know, so this is very stressful. I can remember going to look for a job in New York at one of these National English Professor conferences. And my wife came with me. And I would go to these interviews, and I would come back in the evening, and I just wanted to fade into oblivion, you know. And my wife was just, she was in New York, she was charged up with energy. She said, what's wrong with you? You know, we're in New York, you know. Her uncle was an artist who had a loft in Brooklyn. And she was just having a ball, and it was like, what's wrong with you? Get up, you know. And I just felt like I'd been run over by a steamroller, you know. But it was the psychology of it, right? You know, it was stress. So I think this is true. You know, I think that the modern world just, I mean, maybe it's just me, but I think we weren't really necessarily made for the complexity of the modern world. And so I think it's very difficult for people to be natural and happy, actually, and sane. You know, I really think those are very difficult under the current circumstances. A fairly large number of people are quite dysfunctional. You know, that's actually true. You know, a lot of people, I know many people who are on antidepressants right now as I speak, people I care about and so on. And I know people who really, really need to see a psychiatrist. In fact, I meet people like that all the time. It's like this person would really deeply benefit from seeing a psychiatrist. And in my work, I run into people like that, and in other casual, you know, people who have real serious problems right under the surface. And I guess, you know, it's very hard not to, you know, because this is a crazy place. It's not what we didn't evolve over 100,000 years, or however millions, 13.7 billion years, however long life has existed. We didn't evolve to deal with these particular frustrations. You know. So I think it makes, I think Zen practice is really quite unique, because I really do believe Zen is like, even though people don't necessarily believe in the idea of like a natural way to live, I think when you do Zazen, I think it resonates. It resonates with our deep. I really do think our evolutionary character. You know, I think that there's something about Zazen which is really very natural, which really does restore a sense of like I can't think of any other way to put it, a natural mind. You know, when I sit on the cushion, and I'm in a deep samadhi, I feel exactly the same way I felt up there in the mountains watching the elk. You know, I feel this wonderful sense of well-being, connectedness, alertness. My body, you know, adrenaline isn't pumping through my body is a calm and animated, this wonderful life energy, you know, pulsating. The other day somebody came to see me, and he was telling me that he had had a sit after the sit, he had had like this incredible explosion of energy. He just said it was astonishing. And he said, what was that? And I actually said, you know, you can feel that quite a bit if you do a lot of Zazen, because normally people are so tense, they're so clenched up, you know, they're always waiting for the next disaster or the next emergency. They're so tight. You know, it's like you're blocking that energy. And when you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, I do really think we return to a kind of natural, there's a natural default position for human consciousness. And I think we get there when we do Zazen. You know, I really do. You know, if you watch your mind, you'll notice that it has a number of different components or layers. If you are just sitting on the cushion, and eventually, if you do Zazen long enough, you begin to notice that there's sort of layered character to awareness in any particular moment. You know, there's a kind of alertness to the moment. You know, there's a part of our minds that's intermittently we're sort of noticing our surroundings, right? It's like intermittently you become aware of like the sound of the fan overhead, or the cool air on your skin, or maybe the cushion is producing a little pressure under your bottom because you've been sitting there for an hour. You don't notice those continuously, but that's like, it keeps coming back. It's like a one layer of consciousness is just awareness of like surroundings, right? There's a deeper level of consciousness which doesn't, we're usually not aware of it, but it's right on the edge of consciousness. You know, it's like you might have had a bad experience at a certain place, and when you go back to that place, you feel yourself getting nervous, right? You know, or you might have had a bad situation, and when you're in a similar situation, you find yourself getting angry. You know, this is like there's a kind of unconscious mind, which is, you know, sort of coming up into consciousness periodically, not all the time, but these are like two layers. There's like, if you watch your mind, you'll notice the mind's aware sort of surroundings. And there's this kind of unconscious mind where you'll suddenly become aware that you're stressed or you're angry or you're happy, right? Those things sort of float up into consciousness. Right? And then there's this other layer. And when you sit on the cushion, you often encounter it, especially if you're a beginner, but it's very persistent. And it's the layer of stuff where when you sit on the cushion, there's like you start reliving the TV show you saw last night, or the movie, or musical songs come through your head as you're sitting, or words, images, things. You'll start sitting on the cushion, and you'll start thinking of George Bush, you know, and the speech he gave last night, and then you'll start responding in language to Bush, you know. You start counter-arguing. You know, here's what I'd say, you know, blah, blah, blah. This is like another layer of the mind. And I really think that layer is, that one in particular is the one that gets us into trouble, you know. It's where we get stuck. And I think that's like the layer of culture, right? It's the layer that's full of like ideas, images, and these things are not eternal. They're not permanent. They were created historically by human beings, you know, and they're floating out there. They're circulating like money. You know, if you pick up a $20 bill, you didn't invent it, right? You just picked it up, and then you use it, and it goes away, right? Well, I think ideas are circulating. It's like we really don't have a single mind You know, it's really, we have, you know, we don't really, our minds are really interconnected on this level. There's a guy named, Merlin Donald. He's a psychologist. And he actually has made this argument. He says that our minds are really all interwoven into this cultural system. It's really a layer of the mind, he says. The products of this TV, radio. And I think it's possible to just get caught or stuck in this layer of the mind, and you can't really control it. You know, the people who control it are people who run Fox Television and work in Hollywood and make movies. And it flows through us, you know, but it's not necessarily good for us. You know, people aren't really making these movies to help us achieve awakening or to be relaxed and calm. They really want to sell us something. So anyway, I think this is the layer of the mind that causes us. Most people think it's real, and they live their lives there, pretty much, you know. But I think it's very short-lived, and it's like this flowing bunch of junk. This is like ocean or river of ideas and images, and it's flowing through all of our minds, but it's not necessarily good for us or healthy, and it's not natural, you know. It's really not. And so, I think when we live too much on that level, we become crazy, you know, really crazy. Because culture is just a mess. It's filled with all kinds of toxic ideas and behaviors, and things you just can't trust. And you can't look to authorities. You know, you can't look to experts. They don't necessarily know anything either. So I think one way to understand what we're doing when we sit on the cushion is we're trying to get free from the power of that layer of the mind, that sort of cultural layer of the mind, and get back to a sort of kind of consciousness that I think is more natural and more trustworthy. You know. People can experience all kinds of things without language and cultural symbols. And they do all the time. And when we sit on the cushion, you know, you stop living so much in that layer of the mind that's the cultural language part of the mind. That river of money-like ideas that's just circulating from you to him to her to him, and you know. And you start spending more time in the moment, you know, and just that layer of the mind where you're just aware of your surroundings. And you find yourself calm, connected, trusting. And if you stay there a little while longer, you know, your unconscious mind and your conscious mind begin to start working harmoniously together. That's how they really were made to work, but I'm afraid we've gotten a little screwed up. But once you can rest serenely in the moment, and the thinking machine begins to calm down, it's like normally the thinking machine is going bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub- know, the idea is it's just the blah, 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 blah. It's like trying to meditate next to like somebody's doing something with a jackhammer on the street. You just, it's very hard. So when you meditate long enough, it's like the machine starts closing down. It's like blah, 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 blah. And there's these little intervals where it just, the idea part of your mind just stops. And you just rest serenely in the moment. Okay? And if you can stay there long enough, it's like you begin to get in touch not just with the world around you, but with your unconscious mind. And these things start floating up into your awareness like memories, fears, things that you forgot about for 30 years. And these control our behavior in destructive ways too, you know. So it's like the cultural part is destructive, and in some ways some aspects of the unconscious mind are destructive. But if we rest with that level of the mind that is just aware of the moment, just aware of its surroundings, we become, I think that's our natural home, and we become calm and stable and serene, trusting, alert. And then we can begin to decondition ourselves and be really healthy, healthy people, you know, happy people, no matter what happens. So I realize this is kind of weird, this talk today. I hope it made some sense. And if it didn't, it doesn't matter. Just please just keep sitting, you know, just keep sitting. Main subject. Sancho said to Seppo, "The golden carp is out of the net." You know, we have so many nets. There's so many nets. You know, so many nets. How do we get out of these nets? See, sometimes it just seems impossible. There's a golden carp trapped in the net. That's like your heart, your mind, right? How do I get out of these nets? Get me out of these nets. Sancho said to Seppo, "The golden carp is out of the net." It's out. When your mind is free, what are you going to feed on? What will you be aware of when your mind is free? You can get out of the net. You can get out of the net. And he said, when it's out, what's it like? When it's out of the net, what's it like? That's basically what he's saying. Tell me about what the mind is like when it's out of the net. And Seppo says, when you get out of the net, I'll tell you. It's kind of a Zen master answering a Zen master. Sancho said, "The renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot even find one word to say about this topic." In other words, you're supposed to be a great Zen master, but you haven't said one word to answer my question, which is really a compliment, right? And Seppo says, "I'm the chief abbot, and I have a lot to do. Don't be so hard on me," which means, you know, you're my friend, and I'm glad you're here today. Sancho's verse, "The golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say it remains in the water still. It shakes the heavens and moves the earth, swinging its fins, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale, raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds, and a cool breeze comes." See, I mean, every once in a while, you know, the world is a crazy place, and it's very stress-producing, and it's nuts, really. Really. I mean, look at history. It's history is mostly tragedy, right? You know, mostly just tragedy, almost unbearable. So, you know, nets, 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 nets. It's like burning, the burning heat of pressure and stress. But you know, every once in a while, we sit on the cushion, and you feel like you're right at the heart of everything. If you're sitting any length of time, you must have these moments where you just feel so alive and so connected, and it's so beautiful. And there's no reason for it to be like that. There doesn't have to be a reason. The universe doesn't have reasons, right? It's just pure being is beautiful and wonderful. And when you feel that way, it's like being in a cool room, or sitting on a veranda and having a cool breeze fan your face in the shadows on a hot day, right? It's just that cool is so beautiful. Right? That's what, you know, we sit on the cushion and we enter that beautiful, cool, natural state. A cool breeze, yes, a cool breeze. Who in the whole universe knows about this? Everybody's burning up with stress and pressure. Do they even know that this is possible? You know. But it is. And I hope you had a little taste of it today. And if you didn't, please keep practicing. That's what Zen is all about. That's what Zen is all about. It's really possible to live a wonderful life if you just get in touch with your true self. So thank you very much for coming here.